The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Probably the biggest trend in education lately, and certainly the most contentious, is school closure. Officials using testing to evaluate school performance and close the ones that are underperforming. Recently, we've heard more parents and educators, even some school officials, criticizing that approach. They say it punishes teachers and students for economic and social issues that affect student achievement, and that closing schools and opening new ones is destabilizing rather than helpful. There's been a lot of school closure here in New York. Sometimes it still makes the news.
Keep the school open. Give it the resources it needs.
Like when a once prestigious old school, like Jamaica High School out in Queens, shut down.
New York City Department of Education is planning to close Jamaica High School.
Jamaica High School has an incredibly proud history. Its alumni include several Pulitzer Prize winners and Olympians. As recently as the mid-'80s, when the New Yorker's Jelani Cobb was a student there, it was cited as an outstanding school on the national level. But it shut down in 2014, and Jelani went back recently to find out what had happened.
I graduated in 1987, and Jamaica does have a reputation in New York City. For one, it was an academically rigorous institution, and it was known for producing really high-caliber students. It also had a kind of no-nonsense tradition. I lived in a community about a mile and a half south of the school called South Jamaica. It was mostly working class. There were some, you know, poor families who lived there as well. And that was a really important thing, you know, for my parents particularly, that I lived in a neighborhood that probably wasn't the best, but I was zoned for one of the best schools in the city. There's a story that illustrates the kind of place that Jamaica was, and it takes place not long after September 11th. At a point where there was still a lot of tension in the public, people were really afraid, and you know, you saw it manifest in different ways in different places. I was on an airplane, and I just boarded and sat down, and I saw a gentleman coming down the aisle. And he was a brown-skinned man, and he had on kind of a flowing tunic outfit and, you know, baggy pants, and people kind of saw him and identified him as Muslim. You can almost see the tension ratcheting up as he comes closer and closer. And he then sits down across the aisle from me. And I look over and realize that I recognize him. And I said, "Sheikh?" And he looks over at me kind of quizzically. And I said, "It's Jelani. We were in the same breakdance group in high school." And you could see everyone just kind of relax, like the tension just dissipated. Because like, oh, he was a breakdancer in high school and, you know, he's not going to do anything to harm us. The irony of it was that, you know, I'm a large African-American man and I'm actually in the position of making a group of white people feel more safe and comfortable, which is not how I typically experience the world. But the more notable thing to me was that Jamaica was the kind of place where a black kid from the south side of the borough and a Pakistani Muslim who was from not far from the school could meet and bond over our mutual interest in breakdancing. So I would take the Q5 bus. I went back to the neighborhood recently. I wanted to see my school since it had closed. Back in high school, I rode a bus 45 minutes each way to get to school.
And then we'd get off and start walking up this hill. You know, that old story about people's parents who said they walked uphill 5 miles each morning to go to school. And that was kind of like, we felt like we had some equivalent of that just by braving this particular hill early in the morning. My parents moved to Queens in about 1967, and I was born in 1969. And moving to Queens was a big deal at that point. You know, the black population in Queens was coming from Harlem, you know, the Bronx, communities where, you know, African Americans had largely been restricted to living. And this hill is legendary. People just kind of refer to it as the hill.
When you get to it near the top of the hill, you see this majestic building.
And as you see it,
the building itself resembled a state capitol.
This magnificent structure, you know, with these two wings and this long central corridor connecting it and this rolling green, you know, in front of it. Looking at the building, it's a wildly idealistic undertaking to just say, let's build this magnificent structure and then teach people here.
For most of its history, that idealism was rewarded, until it wasn't. In the early 2000s, New York City adopted a policy of school choice, which allowed students to enroll in any high school in the city. That policy, combined with demographic changes that brought larger numbers of low-income and non-English-speaking students into the school, made it harder for Jamaica to compete. Other schools began siphoning off top students that once would have applied to Jamaica. By 2009, the graduation rate had sunk to 39%. 2 years later, the New York City Department of Education decided to close the school. When I visited, I found my school covered with scaffolding.
So you can't really see just how incredible the structure is on its own. You kind of have to use your imagination. You graduated in...
So I wanted to talk to a recent graduate
12?
Who could talk about...
Are you not sure?
...what Jamaica was like toward the end of its existence.
2013, I'm sorry. It's 2013. I was a class of 2013.
Kimberly Walcott graduated a couple years ago. Today, four smaller schools occupy the space that once held just one school.
So what was interesting to me is, like, when I was here, there seemed to be a lot of activities. You know, I wound up participating in, you know, science programs and played baseball. And, you know, there was another program for students who were interested in business, medical careers. Was that like your experience? Or where did you feel like you had those opportunities?
When I came here, I was accepted as a law. I think they had a law program.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else just sort of fizzled out. We just became, like, I guess, the lower class in the school.
So the other thing that I remember that was notable about this school is that it kind of looked like the United Nations. You know, so we had, you know, students from all over the Caribbean. We had students from former Soviet bloc countries who were here. We had Lithuanian students, Russian students, South Asian students, East Asian students. And, you know, there was just this incredible diversity of the population.
There was not a diverse, I mean, in the beginning, a bit more than how it ended. At the end, there were just a majority of Caribbean students, Haitians, yeah, Caribbean, a lot of Caribbean, no white American. I don't remember, probably very few, like, to count. I could probably count, actually.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, they're closed.
Yeah. Oh, you can kind of see through this glass here a little bit. And that glass case has yearbooks going back through all Jamaica's history. And I remember being excited that 1987 was in there, like, because not all of the yearbooks are just kind of random selections. I was like, oh, yeah, we made the cut.
So, oh, gosh.
So apparently they weren't too ashamed of us. So here's a kind of not good story.
Okay.
So we're at the central entrance here for the high school. If you go through those doors, you'll be in the main corridor, and directly across from you is the auditorium. And in 1986, we would typically meet in the mornings before classes started, and we would kind of mill around in the auditorium and talk. And that particular morning, there was a conflict between a young man by the name of Stanley Pacheco and another young man by the name of Gregory Evelyn. And Greg pulled out a gun and shot
Stanley and in the auditorium.
I heard of that incident, but I wasn't sure of how it went down. You were actually here for that.
I was here. I was a student here.
Wow.
Yeah. And
what was it like?
Unfortunately, school shootings are common now. But at this point in time, we did not have any frame of reference for something like that happening. And the school went on, but we were, for the rest, and that was my senior year, for the rest of the year, that incident kind of hung over us.
I was going to say, I think that was probably the reason for a lot of the bad name that Jamaica High School got.
That's kind of amazing to me that something that happened almost 30 years before you graduated, and it's shocking that people were still talking about it, that you still knew.
Yeah, I was aware, but it wasn't like we sort of constantly talked about it. You know, just it was brought up, and then we're like, oh, wow, maybe that's the reason why Jamaica's quote-unquote a bad school.
And so I think that's one of the things that's interesting, too. Like, when we close schools, we're not just closing the school. You know, what we're doing is closing a particular history. I don't know what exactly should have happened here. When the school closed, about 63% of the students here qualified as low income. It almost seemed like a no-brainer. Like, if you're going to have that population, you have to have the resources to address what their needs are. And for a long time, it seems like this was a place where that happened, and then it was a place where that ceased to happen. It's fenced off, and it looks like a funeral shroud almost, and it's a metaphor for a particular kind of idea about education, I think. One of the things that was most notable to me about this story is that when it came out that same week, a group of parents and community members had begun a hunger strike to prevent the closure of Dyett High School in Chicago. And it struck me that this is not just a local story. It's not just a personal story. It's really a national story. And there are lots of people in lots of different places who are concerned about what happens when an institution in their community closes. On the surface, it's hard to understand why a community would protest the closure of a failing school. But people weren't protesting to keep a failing school open. They were protesting because they believed that institution had the potential to be great once again. Most of the people who I grew up with did not wind up going to college or did not wind up going to graduate school or having opportunities that I wound up having. And I kind of look and say there's one less way for that person. Someone coming from the community that I came from who has those aspirations to get to where they want to be in life now.
That's staff writer Jelani Cobb at his alma mater, Jamaica High School.